My name is Mohit Kumar Jolly. I'm an associate professor at Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore.
And I am Panvi Bahia, a neuroscientist, science communicator, and your host for Biology in Numbers, a podcast by the Society for Mathematical Biology, also known to its close friends as the SMB. Mohit, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure and honor to be here. Looking forward to it.
Of course. I also look forward to speaking with you. As this is a podcast about mathematical biology, I'd like to ask you a mean question as to whether you are team math or team bio.
Either answer would leave a set of people unhappy, so I'll nonetheless proceed with one of them. I have been trained as a bioengineer, so I would incline towards team bio.
Okay. That I didn't see from your CV. That's really interesting. We'll get back to your kind of history and how you got into the field later. But my next challenge to you is to get you to describe your research in 60 seconds or less.
Sure. So we try to understand, in the context of cancer, the two major challenges that are faced in the clinic: how cells move from one organ to another, the process of metastasis, and how cells develop resistance against the therapies that are currently used, using mathematical models of different kinds and working very closely with experimental as well as clinical data. So some of the work we have done in this context is to elucidate that as cancer cells achieve these two ambitious goals, they do that by reversibly switching back and forth different behaviors instead of having a predetermined code to be able to do this. And this was some of the initial predictions that we had made using our mathematical models and now have been extensively validated and has begun the paradigm in the field when people think about the dynamics of these processes.
That's so interesting. But sticking with SMB right now, what does the Society for Mathematical Biology mean to you as a researcher in the field?
Well, it means a lot. As a young graduate student, or even earlier than that, as a master's student trying to figure out how to get into mathematical biology, SMB was the first door I knocked. And I have never been disappointed. Many experts in the field have very generously shared their time, expertise, insights into how to get into the field. Because as you said in the previous question, there's some people entering from team math, some entering from team bio. They don't necessarily speak each other's language. They don't know where to go. They don't know if they can go together. And if yes, then how? So all of those questions, which of course I'm still also trying to figure out an answer for, but SMB was the place to get many of those, at least starting to get some of those answers. And I try to pay back to be as active a member of the community in different roles. I have been the co-chair of Mathematical Oncology subgroup earlier, and also try to encourage many other early career researchers to join the membership, attend meetings, and network with some of the experts in the field.
Yeah, I think that's so important because it's very easy to become a member of any organization and be very kind of passive about the way that you participate, right? You get your emails coming through all the time from the mailing lists, and you show up to the meeting once a year. I think it takes a real commitment to then say, yes, I'm going to be involved. I'm going to make sure that I hand the torch over to the next generation.
Absolutely. And one of the ways we have been trying to do this is by organizing mini symposium at different SMB annual meetings. So I usually try to have one of my graduate students with me so that they also get the experience of how to put together a mini symposium, how to get speakers across different backgrounds and disciplines who are working on a specific area, and also then bring SMB to a wider audience, some of the colleagues who might not necessarily have attended earlier SMB annual meetings or so on.
Yeah, that's a tremendous way of giving mentorship. I can't imagine as a graduate student being involved in something like that. But you have also been marked out for us by current president Jane as having been awarded the Arthur Winfrey Prize. So can you please tell us a little bit more about who Arthur Winfrey was and what the prize was given for?
Absolutely. It's such a pleasure and honor to receive this prestigious award. Arthur Winfrey was a legendary theoretical biologist who yielded many new insights into multiple different biological systems that vary across scales of length, time, and biological organization. Thinking about slime molds all the way to contractions in heart and arrhythmias, so that's just the scope of the work that I'm aware of. And this prize honors a theoretician or a mathematician whose work has inspired new biology. And as I was mentioning earlier, some of the predictions we made were that these processes of cancer metastasis and drug resistance could be driven by reversible switches in cellular behavior rather than a predetermined path encoded in the DNA per se. So cells could have the same DNA, the same genotype as it is called, but they can still have multiple behaviors or phenotype as it is called. And some of the initial work we had done was that in the context of metastasis, it was usually thought of as a two-state scenario that cells would either stay stuck to each other and not move at all, or they would move as single cells through the bloodstream, which is the predominant mode in which cancer cells metastasize. And we made these predictions at this point more than a decade ago that it is not a two-state process. Cells can actually move collectively. And when they move collectively, they could achieve much higher rates of metastasis. And these predictions have now been extensively validated in multiple different cancers. And we're currently, as a community, trying to identify what are some unique properties of cells when they move collectively. Why is whole greater than sum of its parts? And how can we target these collectively migrating cells in the bloodstream in the clinic?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that my husband, David Basanta, is obviously in the same field. And he said, you know, you are a rising star. And that work certainly sounds worthy of that kind of prize. What's really interesting to me as a biologist is that the majority of the biological field still probably does not appreciate the extent to which mathematics and theoretics helps to drive biological ideas. Do you still kind of incur that within your own work, where you realize that for this particular problem, like, it's so interesting to me that the biologists will have learned as a result of your models?
Oh, absolutely. I think the role of mathematics in biology, at least in cancer biology or disease biology, largely speaking, is still at its beginning. We can do much more. I mean, of course, the role of mathematics in ecology and epidemiology is relatively more well established as we speak. Absolutely. And I have really enjoyed working together with many excellent cancer biologists who have been very open-minded in their approach and welcoming of ideas coming from different disciplines. And I'm also very appreciative of the work that David and Connor, for instance, have done together as a team, a mathematician and a biologist teaming up together and thinking about bone metastasis, particularly in the context of prostate cancer. So yes, it would be fantastic to have many more such teams come together of people coming from diverse backgrounds and enriching the overall understanding of the field. Because again, I think when we try to understand cancer, it's the whole elephant and blind man story, that whatever a particular aspect is being looked at under one zoomed in level is what would be focused on. But clearly it's much, much more than that. And that is why we are still trying to battle this particular menace, both in our lives as well as at a medical level.
Absolutely. Very well put. So talking a little bit more about your work experience and your background, I think that there are probably many members of SMB who are familiar with what it's like in the US and Europe, for example. But can you tell us more about the educational system in India? Because this might be a bit more unfamiliar.
Absolutely. So the education system in India, usually after class 10 or grade 10, sort of bifurcates into whether you want to be an engineer or a doctor. Of course, there are many more options now, but I'm talking about when I was growing up. And then the basics of calculus do come into grade 11 and 12 and later on. So that's why students who choose the biology route never really see the true math and its applications in the context of different fields of biology. And my story is not very different as well. I chose the path of physics, chemistry, mathematics as the subjects in grade 11 and 12, but then ended up choosing biological sciences and bioengineering as the major during my undergrad. And this was at Indian Institute of Technology, IIT Kanpur, the entrance to which is through a highly competitive exam. There used to be five initial IITs that were set up in the 1950s and 60s, and now there are more than 20 of them, almost one in each state of the country. Now, most IITs, if not all, have a biology department. So students who might not have chosen biology in grade 11 and 12 still have an opportunity to learn biology. And I'm told that many, again, if not all IITs have a core first year undergrad course in biology. So their students are getting exposed to what different unanswered questions exist at different scales of biological organization, and really hope that this would accelerate the entry of many more colleagues in the field of mathematical biology.
So is there something special about this network of IIT universities? Because clearly they set them up for a particular reason, right?
Oh, absolutely. So initially when they were set up, right around the time when the country gained independence, was to build a critical mass of technical personnel, which of course has happened. And many of the IIT graduates are doing fantastic in different fields of professional careers that they have chosen. Also recently, what is happening is that many of the IITs are developing a very strong research portfolio, which is very healthy for growing and developing countries such as India. And currently, many of these IITs are setting up large interdisciplinary centers and PhD programs. So the institute I am at, Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore, they have had a mathematical biology PhD program for over a decade, which is amazing because it gets students from different backgrounds to work on these questions. And interestingly, for this particular PhD program at my university, their criteria is that there should be two advisors, ideally one from mathematics and one from biology background, or certainly from different departments. So they are trying all these different ways to promote cross-fertilization of ideas, concepts, and train the next generation of researchers who are not ossified in their mindset when it comes to what different disciplines are. And as a matter of fact, these disciplinary boundaries were created in school for convenience of education, but nature doesn't know these boundaries. Hopefully, this is a sentiment that can be passed down to future generations.
Yeah, certainly. So out of curiosity, given the kind of educational differences, I know that you went and did your PhD in the US. How different or how much of an effort was it to make sure that those, the kind of transcripts that you had and the grades were easily translated between countries? Because, you know, the US system is very different. And often when you're trying to enter into a new system, it's quite difficult to help people interpret, okay, these were my grades and this is what it meant in that context.
Absolutely. I think in that context, what helped was that the department where I did my PhD has had many other graduate students earlier from one of the IITs. So they were able to presumably convert what exactly a GPA of some particular value on a scale of 10 means equivalent to a GPA on a scale of 10. It's not just a division by 2.5. but also sort of setting the context in which these grades are given and what it means. So having that familiarity with at least the IIT system certainly helped.
Very good. So I wanted to kind of go back to the beginning of your research journey and to find out what was it that inspired you to get into mathematical biology specifically?
So when I started my undergrad in biological sciences and bioengineering, I was constantly looking for other physics and mathematics courses because that's the background that I was coming from in the last 2 years of schooling, and to see whether they can be applied to better understand the biological systems that I was getting introduced to at that point of time. And again, I was extremely fortunate that there were many faculty members in the physics and maths and other engineering departments at IIT Kanpur who were looking into some of these questions, not necessarily the same questions that the biology faculty members were looking at, but at least that approach existed. And the IIT curriculum was reasonably flexible enough for me to take some of those courses and to begin to appreciate how to work at this interface. At the end of my undergrad, I wasn't really sure if this is what I really wanted to do. So I stayed on there for my master's thesis, and my master's thesis advisor was very kind, an experimental developmental biologist who agreed to take a student who said on day one, I will not dissect flies and I will do some mathematical modeling. So I think it's all due to very supportive mentors that I was able to enter the field. And one thing I must mention is that around 2011, 2012 period, there were many, many workshops in India across different cities through a network called as National Network for Mathematical and Computational Biology. SMB was also involved in sponsoring some of those workshops. And what they were doing was basically going out to different parts of the country and training undergrad and master's and PhD students, saying that a field called mathematical biology exists. This is how you can get into it. These are the people who are looking into it, be it immunology, ecology, epidemiology, cell biology, developmental biology, neuroscience. I didn't really find much cancer biology, but yes, there was some of it as well. So yeah, it was just the being there at the right place at the right time in multiple instances and having very supportive mentors that allowed me to enter the field.
Wonderful. So having talked about how you got to where you are, can you tell us more about your current research? Obviously, your website has multiple really interesting projects. So can you please describe a couple of them for us?
Absolutely. So the central theme of the focus in our group is to decode cancer as a complex adaptive ecosystem, to begin to appreciate that it is indeed that. Cancer biology has been largely approached from a reductionist and descriptive perspective. And that categorization of specific molecules in terms of whether they are so-called oncogenes or so-called tumor suppressor genes has been helpful, but it doesn't really give us a predictive model as to if I were to upregulate or increase the level of gene A by 5 times and simultaneously decrease the level of gene B by 2 times, what is the outcome? That predictive understanding is clearly, certainly missing right now. So what we try to do is take that information that is out there in the literature and see when we integrate all that different information, each of which has been perhaps reported by a specific group or a set of papers, and then see when we put all that information together, all those interactions between different molecules together, what is the outcome? And can that outcome or set of outcomes explain the experimental and or clinical observations that we have? So just to give you an example, in the context of, say, skin cancer or melanoma, what initially the community had identified is that there are cells which can grow much faster, but they migrate slower. Or there are cells which can migrate faster but grow slower. So that was the go or grow hypothesis that was there in the field. And this was seen not just in the laboratory in tissue culture plates, but also in mouse models or in vivo, as we call it. So we wanted to understand, well, what is the minimum set of interactions among different molecules that have been reported in the literature, which would allow cells to have these, at least these two states or phenotypes, and also switch back and forth between them. So we went into the literature, identified some top players that have been very well studied in the literature and how they regulate each other. So again, each of this piece of information was available, but what was not available is when you synthesize this information as to which molecule controls which other molecule in which manner, and then you write down a set of equations, mathematical equations, which represent those rules or those dynamics, then what is the outcome possible? So we were able to identify that by looking at just 5 molecules, you could explain that cells can take not just these 2 states, but also multiple intermediate states somewhere in between. And it was these states which was also governing the response to therapies in the context of melanoma, be it immunotherapy, be it targeted therapy. So we were able to explain a whole bunch of experimental data, which was publicly available, much of which was publicly available. And using this information embedded in the literature, but not synthesized and not giving us insights into the emergent properties.
Yeah, that's quite daunting as a problem when you put it this way, to say that. Because obviously the standard thinking, at least within the medical field, has been, we will apply this chemotherapy, then we'll apply this chemotherapy. And there's not a lot of understanding of what the cells are doing. It just seems like a very difficult task then it seems almost insurmountable to be able to develop the treatments for people as they need them. If in a single individual, it's not one cancer. How do you see this as being something that we can then treat in the future?
Absolutely. I think, as you rightly pointed out, some of the medical approaches, for instance, chemotherapy, the idea there is let's target the fast killing cells. And that is why we see some of the side effects of chemotherapy, because the organs that have a high percentage of fast dividing cells are also then targeted unwillingly by the drugs that are being administered to the patient. So clearly this whole idea about let's give the maximum dose that a patient can tolerate and hopefully it will have the maximum impact, that linear thinking has its limits. And some of the exciting work being done at Moffitt Cancer Center currently is on this idea of adaptive therapy or intermittent therapy, that let's not have the goal as to eliminate every single cancer cell, because our work and many other colleagues in the field have shown what that sometimes what does not kill cancer can make it stronger. Basically, some therapies can induce a more aggressive behavior in a subpopulation of cancer cells, which may worsen the situation, at least at longer time scales. So the idea of these alternate administration of therapies is that let's change the goal. The goal can be to perhaps keep the total tumor mass or tumor volume below a threshold such that it would not lead to more aggressive outcomes. Sort of similar to as we control hypertension today, that one can take a pill and keep the blood pressure under a given threshold. So some of these ideas I'm really excited about, and hopefully they'll be integrated into clinical practice as well after due diligence being done at different levels. And this is where I see the role of mathematics getting even more important, because when you're dealing with such a complex system, which has so many variables, so many interactions, and we still do not know what are the different consequences of any therapy being given. We know what it is targeting, one thing, but we cannot say that's the only thing it's targeting. It's clearly giving rise to a whole bunch of other impacts as well, which need to be characterized, put into the mathematical model as accurately as possible and as iteratively as possible, so that we can continue to refine the mathematical model or a set of mathematical models, which can eventually aim to help the design of therapies in the clinic.
So obviously the work you're doing is so important, and I hope that other people also can appreciate that this is such a complex subject and that it's not going to be some magic pill that's given at some point to cure the disease. So while I was looking through your website, there was something that I kind of want to indulge as a question for me. So as a biologist myself, I am aware of the kind of the genetic mechanisms for cancers being able to evade responses to therapy, right? So basically something happens, you have a mutation in the DNA, and this gives the cell some property which says, oh, okay, I don't have to deal with this chemotherapy anymore. But you mentioned on the website, you talk about these non-genetic mechanisms. How do those work?
So non-genetic mechanisms is another layer of control on top of the genetic mechanism. So genetic mechanisms, as you rightly mentioned, that there are changes in the DNA which are then heritable, and the offspring that this particular cell will give rise to will have all these properties in this particular case, for instance, being resistant to a given therapy because of changes in the DNA. Non-genetic mechanisms operate on the premise that even if there is no genetic mutation, even if the DNA is the same, one could still have different behaviors. And that adds on to the complexity, because genetic mechanisms are certainly predisposing a subpopulation of cells to a particular behavior. But because there are additional layers of complexity, we still cannot accurately predict whether a given mutation or having information about the mutational status is necessary or sufficient to say how exactly a population will behave. So that's the context in which this fits in. So clearly genetic mechanisms are setting the landscape in some sense. And what non-genetic mechanisms are enabling cells is to switch back and forth, because genetic mechanisms are irreversible in some sense, right? And again, in the context of metastasis, when cells are experiencing a very dynamically changing behavior and they are usually in circulation for not more than a few weeks or days, perhaps. Genetic mechanisms are not the solution for the cells because A, they are very slow, and B, they are irreversible. Non-genetic mechanisms are fast and reversible. So they allow cancer cells to increase their fitness during that journey when they are going through multiple bottlenecks, which are also changing with time and space. And therefore, making the genetic mechanisms, again, not being sufficient to be able to predict whether a cancer cell will metastasize or not. And if it does, then how long it will be before a clinically observable mass shows up at a given distant organ in the body.
Okay, very good. So one of the things that we generally like to do for this podcast is to keep the language relatively accessible so that we can speak to as broad an audience as possible. But we also like to give our researchers a chance to kind of nerd out about the techniques that they use. So can you tell us a little about the models that you employ in your research?
Absolutely. So most of the work that we do in the group is based on ordinary differential equations, which means we do not consider space as a component. We look at interactions of these molecules in time. However, more recently, some of the questions that we are getting into do include partial differential equations or also agent-based models, where clearly space also becomes a component because we know cells are interacting with each other in different manners. They are changing the behavior of each other. They are also constantly engaging with the extracellular matrix and so on. So these models allow us to then encapsulate some of those dynamics in a more accurate representation. But we do face challenges that when we particularly look at the spatial context, then solving these equations becomes extremely challenging from a computational perspective. So we are working on how to reduce dimensionality in our ordinary differential equation based setup. Do we really need every single variable to be able to predict how a system is going to behave? Or can we develop models where we identify which variables are contributing the most and then use that reduced dimensionality information to then speed up our spatial simulations? And particularly in the past 5 years or so, there has been such a blast of data at the spatial level, both imaging and omics, that has come out in the field of tumor microenvironment and in patients who respond versus do not respond mouse models and also real patient data. We really want to leverage on insights that can be gained from that and see how close we can get from our models to be comparing to that kind of data that is emerging. And now there's single cell and spatial data. So clearly the data is coming out at an unprecedented rate. Technology is developing very fast. Mathematical models have such an opportunity to leverage that information and go to the next step of making more accurate predictions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, again, as a biologist, the amount of data that you can get out of a single mouse or animal or experiment these days will fill entire gigabyte drives that can store such things. So yeah,
certainly.
It certainly would help to have better ways of interpreting that. So those were all the questions I had regarding your work. But as we always like to do is include a couple of questions at the end to demonstrate that our scientists are human beings as well, and that you have fun and interests outside of research. So the first of my quickfire questions is, if your lab had a mascot, or rather your group, what would it be and why?
I think we already have an informal mascot, which is a cup of tea. And my thesis defense last slide was, where there is chai, there is hope, or where there is tea, there is hope. And that has become sort of an informal mascot. We all hang out much more over a cup of tea and having these discussions as a group and also as other collaborators rather than actual group meetings. So that really embodies the spirit of what tea can do to elevate your research further.
Very good. It sounds very similar to my last postdoc position when I was in London, where basically the team would have the next cup of tea brewing while you're drinking the first one.
Yeah, that happens here as well.
So the next question is, do you have a favorite movie soundtrack? If so, what is it?
That's a difficult one. I have many, and it's hard to pick up one of them, but probably the soundtrack All Is Well from the movie Three Idiots is among the top ones.
Very good. And a fun movie as well.
Absolutely.
So my last one I have is, what is your favorite annual holiday and why?
I would say Diwali, because that brings many sweets, many people together. And that has been such a rich cultural value to the upbringing that I've had, and many fond memories over the years with many colleagues, friends, and family, of course. So yeah, that continues to be at the top of my list, and we try to hang out as a group as well over Diwali or around Diwali to celebrate the spirit of it.
Wonderful. That sounds very lovely. And I guess with that, I will say thank you again for your time. And it's been an absolute pleasure and super interesting subject, which I'm sure a lot of people, even outside of the field, will be intrigued to hear about.
Thank you so much. It was such a fun conversation, and really looking forward to meeting you in person as well and discussing some of these ideas further. Thank you once again.
Thank you. You've been listening to Biology in Numbers, a podcast from the Society for Mathematical Biology and produced by me, Pamfe Bahia, at Arts Science Media. A reminder that if you're doing cool stuff within the field of math biology and you'd like a chance to be featured, email Jane Heffernan at president@smb.org. Make sure that you go ahead and pitch your research project, your involvement with SMB, and why you think you should be featured, and we'll look forward to picking some new stars for the pod. As always, you can learn more about SMB on the website smb.org and via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Find the links to all of these and some for today's guest in the episode show notes. Finally, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite platform, and if you like the show, give us some love by reviewing.